at this time. We're so very thankful for another privilege this day to come apart from the cares and the troubles of the world to assemble ourselves in this auditorium with those of like precious faith. We ask thy blessing upon us this day, for thou cleanse our hearts and minds from all distracting thoughts, that we might be receptive to receive thy word, thy spiritual truth, this day. And we ask now thy blessing upon the one whom thou hast raised up at this time, our dear brother Carl, that through his lips from thy precious holy word there may be a message for each and every one of us, our firm foundation to rely on in these troublous times. So we pray that his words may be blessed and unctuous to us all. So we leave this day of convention and thy care and keeping, asking that thy presence and thy spirit dwell with us. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
A very rich portion, I'm certain, to open our convention's day. Brother Carl is especially near and dear to those of the Jersey City Ecclesia. For many years now, he has been a most eagerly sought-after convention speaker. And I must say that personally, I have met few brethren who have so stimulated and who have so blessed by his intensity for the Lord and by his breadth of knowledge and by his fidelity to the harvest message. And so it is indeed a blessed privilege to once more introduce him to the convention. And today, or this morning, he is going to address us on faith's foundation. We know the Lord has blessed him in his preparation, and now the Lord is going to richly bless us as we receive of these words. Brother Carl.
Study this morning is going to be together in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, a chapter I think we're very familiar with, but we want to look at Hebrews 11 today from just a little different perspective than perhaps we usually look at it. Usually when we look at Hebrews 11, at least when I look at Hebrews 11, I look at it from the standpoint of asking the question, what? What were the acts of faith of the ancients by which they became accounted worthy? But today we want to look at a different question, and that's the question, why? Why did the ancients do the acts that they did do? You know, in the first verse of the 11th chapter of Hebrews, it says that faith is not only the substance of things hoped for, but it is also the evidence of things not seen. And faith operates upon evidence. If it were not operating upon evidence, it would not be faith. It would be credulity or superstition. But what makes faith faith is that it is a basis. There is a foundation for faith. But what makes faith different than knowledge is that sometimes that foundation can be very small. Faith can extend a small clue, a small hint, into a big action. It can make decisions as to how to operate based upon sometimes quite small evidences. And what we want to note as we look at the whys, at the operation of how faith is working, that we want to see that in many cases it is working upon just such small evidence. And the object in looking at this is so that as we find our experiences in life, it will encourage us to look for little things, for small hints upon which we may base an action, a belief, or whatever is the procedure in our life that we feel should be based upon that. Now, the 11th chapter gives numerous examples. Our time would not permit an examination of all. We'll just start at the beginning, and we'll go until our time runs out. And we'll leave the rest of that then for your own study. The first example of faith that is given with an individual is in the fourth verse. By faith, Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and by it he, being dead, yet speaketh. Try to place yourself in the positions of Cain and Abel. Why did they offer the gifts that they offered? And I think that in honesty to Cain, we would have to say that Cain offered that which was most precious to him. He was a keeper of the ground. He offered the first fruits from the ground. Abel offered that which was most natural to him. He offered an animal. He was a keeper of the animals. You know, later Israel was told to offer the best, the top 10% of what they produced, not only of animals, but of crops as well. They were to tithe the mint and the cumin and the anise, as well as to tithe the flocks and the herds. So in the initial offering by Cain and Abel, it would be very logical to offer, in the one case, fruit of the ground, and in the other case, an animal. But one is styled an act of faith, and the other is not. What was it then that really established the offering of Abel? Did Abel, when he offered that, offer it more than because he was a keeper of the flocks? Would Abel have offered an animal if he had been a keeper of the ground? We don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us. But the fact that it was an act of faith suggests that if Abel had been, in fact, a farmer, he still would have offered an animal. That it was not because it was what he was in the business of raising, but because he recognized it would be more pleasing to the Lord. And the implication is that Cain could have known the same thing, and that Cain could have offered a more acceptable offering had Cain had the proper faith. Upon what foundation, then, did Abel know that an offering of the animal was what God desired rather than the fruit of the ground? And upon what foundation could Cain have made the same decision? Well, I think perhaps the first thing that may come to our minds is the fact that they probably recognized, they were certainly told by their parents, of that rather unusual experience that happened when they first left the Garden of Eden. How, when they found that they were naked, that they were exposed by their sin before God, they sought to cover themselves with the fruit of the ground, with leaves of figs. And now God said, that's not good enough. What you need is a covering of animal. And God gave them coats of skins. And upon that, there would have been a basis to think and to make a decision of faith that God is more accepted. It is more acceptable to God to have that which is to do with the animal world, which involves the death of a sacrifice. Perhaps not even realizing it foreshadowed Christ, but realizing that there was something that showed that God was more pleased with that. But we think there is another foundation that their faith could have been based on, and that this is hinted in Genesis 4, verse 7. I'm going to read it from the King James, but then we're going to note a change in translation. God is speaking to Cain, and he says, if thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted. And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door, and unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him. Sometimes as we read this in the King James, we are inclined to get the thought that God is saying to Cain, sin is just waiting to get its hold on you and to clutch you. But you notice that as you follow that verse too, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say that sin will rule over you, but it says you shall rule over him. You shall rule over sin. And that did not happen in Cain's case. But one of the things you notice as you study Tabernacle Shadows, if you go into it in any depth, is that in Leviticus, the 16th chapter, where it deals with the sin offerings, that the word translated sin offering is really the word sin. The context of the 16th chapter shows that it is a sin offering and not an animal for sin, but an animal as an offering to balance sin. And the Hebrew word trata has that thought throughout the Old Testament. It can be translated sin offering or sin. And we think here is one of the cases where it should be translated sin offering. And if we take that, notice the difference in thought. If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted. And if thou doest not well, a sin offering lies at the door, and unto thee shall be its desire, and thou shalt rule over him. Now picture yourself in a rural setting of the time, maybe a little lean-to, maybe a little something out in the fields where he is, where God is speaking to him. And God is reasoning with him. Cain, you could have acted on faith. There's an evidence you could have looked for. If you did well by offering the fruit of the ground, wouldn't I have accepted it? And if you didn't do well, which is obvious by the fact I didn't accept it, look, there at the door is a lamb, a sin offering. Go to it. Its desire will be to thee. It won't run away. You can rule over it and you can offer it. It can have an acceptable offering. That the foundation for faith was not totally in the coat experience of Adam and Eve. But we think the implication here is not that Cain and Abel each made one offering, but that Cain and Abel were in the business of perpetually offering to the Lord. And that in doing this, they could have noted what did God accept. And seeing what his acceptance was, they could tailor their offering to that which was acceptable. And if the roles had been reversed, if Cain had been the keeper of the flocks, if Abel had been the farmer, it's very possible that when they first offered, Cain might have offered an animal and Abel might have offered fruit of the ground, but Abel, by his faith, would have seen God accepted the offering of the animal, and next time he would have offered the animal. It was based upon the experience that preceded, and upon this precedence, he established faith and established a principle of faith in his life. The second example, Hebrews 11:5. By faith Enoch was translated that he should not see death and was not found because God had translated him, for before his translation he had this testimony that he pleased God. Now, it's not the scope of our subject this morning to deal with Enoch's translation. There are those who feel that Enoch literally was preserved from death. Certainly that thought is presented consistently in the reprints. There are those that feel, and I would be more inclined personally to view this way, that Enoch did die and that his translation had to do with another aspect. That is not the subject of our discussion this morning. Some say that perhaps it was that he did not with his eyes behold the fact of death. Others say that Enoch died at that time, a very young age of only 365 years. And that we realize in the lifespan of today of 80 years that up to about 20 or 21, you're going uphill. And then all of a sudden you start that long slide into the grave. And then from then on, you see, as I've begun to notice, the death process is working within you. And that he may have been miraculously taken before those death processes actually began to work. And so he did not see experientially the death processes working within him. That, again, we're not taking a position on that at this point. The point we want to make is whatever the translation experience was, the translation was not by faith. If the translation was the removal to some secret part of the earth, if the translation was a sudden death that prevented him from seeing this experiential feelings of death, whatever it might have been, the translation was by miracle. What was by faith was Enoch putting himself into that experience whereby he would be translated. Enoch had to do something. We don't know what. He had to do something that showed God, I'm willing to be whatever this translated means. And I think if we think translated is confusing, Enoch found it more so. That I don't think he knew what this experience was going to be, but he knew whatever it was going to be, it was going to be mighty final. It was going to mark a very distinct change. And he had enjoyed a very pleasant relationship in many ways. He had enjoyed fellowship with God. He had that testimony. He walked with God. Something his other counterparts didn't do, and he could have continued that walking. But he also had the opportunity to step into the unknown whatever this translatable experience was going to be. And upon what evidence did he step forward into this experience? Hebrews 11 tells us, "For before his translation, he had this testimony that he pleased God." The evidence upon which Enoch made whatever step of faith he made was based upon the evidence of a testimony in his own life that he could see, whatever I've done up to now, I can feel that it's been pleasing to God. Therefore, if God has indicated to me to step forward and do this, I'm not afraid. And he stepped forward in faith, knowing that having pleased God, God was a sure rewarder of those who please him. The equivalent in our life is the testimony of the witness of the Holy Spirit. His Spirit witnesses with our spirit that we are the sons of God. And if we have that witness, that we have a relationship with God, upon that, we can step forth in faith, doing many things that otherwise might scare us out of our boots, to realize that whatever it is, because I have a vital relationship with the Lord, I can move and to move forward. Verse 8. Verse 7. By faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. You notice it says in this verse, he was warned of things not seen as yet. In other words, he too was told that there was going to be something that not only he had not seen, but was beyond the realm of precedent. There's going to be a flood. How do you make a flood? Well, you cause it to rain. What's rain? He hadn't even seen rain as of yet, and let alone a flood. Where's the water going to come from? Up there. I've lived for 600 years and I haven't seen it come yet. You know, and yet, in faith, he believed that there was going to be not only rain, but so much of it, there was going to be a flood. Upon what evidence could he base that faith? We realize that Noah did not have the Bible. But we believe that Noah had all the information of the first five chapters of Genesis. These were passed on from generation to generation. And so that he knew what was in the experiences preceding him. We'd like to notice something from the first chapter of Genesis that we think was common knowledge in Noah's day, upon which he could have based his faith that, yes, there will be a flood. We're going to notice several verses in Genesis 1, just parts of verses. Notice this in Genesis 1, 4. On the first creative day, God saw the light, that it was good. Then let's move on down to verse 10, the third creative day. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas. And God saw that it was good. And let's first down to verse 12 on the third day also, when the grass comes forth, the last phrase, and God saw that it was good. And then we come to the fourth creative day, verses 14 to 18. And notice in verse 18, the end of the verse, and God saw that it was good. And then in the fifth creative day, verse 20 to 23, you notice in verse 21, the last phrase, and God saw that it was good. And on the sixth creative day, in verse 25, the last phrase, and God saw that it was good. And then, of course, you come to the last verse, and God saw everything that he made, and it was very good. And by that time, it was just fine. But you notice the repetitive phrase, and God saw that it was good. And God saw that it was good. But now, let's go back, and let's read verses 6 to 8. And notice what isn't there. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. God didn't say it was good. The second creative day is the only day lacking the testimony, and God saw that it was good. And we think Noah knew this. We think he must have thought about that. I'm sure you're thinking about it as I've thought about it. Why didn't God say it was good? And we think the reason is because it wasn't good. That's the implication here. That when he said it was good on the other days, he meant the work which I have designed this day to accomplish has been accomplished. It's completed, and I'm satisfied. And when he said everything done, I'm very satisfied. But the work of the second day was not accomplished, because the division of the waters from the waters was only partially accomplished on the second day. There were still waters that were not divided from waters. And now God told Noah, there's going to be water coming down. Should I believe it? As you thought about the day, well, that day wasn't completed. That division of waters was not yet complete. There was a slight clue in that, that perhaps there was still further division of waters to come. And the flood completes the work of the second creative day. Here you have the final and full division of the waters, the final fall. And we think it's also a tend to support this concept of a canopy type theory of the waters being separated from the waters and the dropping of the canopies. That there was a basis for the faith of Noah. Verse 8. By faith Abraham, when he was called to go into a place which he abode, which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed. And he went out, not knowing whither he went. Here the act of faith in Abraham's part was not only in leaving Ur of the Chaldees, but leaving there not knowing where he was going. He went not knowing his destination. Now we'd like to notice something back in Genesis 11 and 12 that may seem to conflict on this, although we don't think it does. In verse 12, chapter 12, verse 1, Now the Lord said unto Abram, Get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee. He doesn't say, Leave here and go to Israel, to Canaan, to Palestine, to the land where he finally went. He just said, Don't worry, I'll tell you where to go when the time comes. Now it's true in chapter 11, verse 31, he does say, And Terah took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran his son's son, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, and his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with him from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. And they came to Haran and dwelt there. But we don't think that's a conflict. We don't think that when they left, they knew they were going to Canaan. We think the point is that this is written after the fact, and written after the fact, that is where he left there to go. But Hebrews 11 says, he went not knowing whither he went. He went to places unknown. That was his destination. When he first left, I think it's further implied that he didn't go to Canaan because there was a caravan route then existent that has been proved archaeologically across the desert directly from Ur to Canaan. And he didn't go that way. He took the more natural route of the migrant, following the fertile crescent of the Euphrates until he got to Haran. And then he had to stop because his father was sick. And after his father died, then he made the decision to go to Canaan. Why? What did he base that decision on to go to Canaan? Why didn't he go on to Ugarit, the end of that route? Why didn't he stay in Haran? How did he know where to go? Perhaps God told him. Perhaps, I don't know. Can't prove he did, I can't prove he didn't. The Bible doesn't say that God did tell him. Since the Bible doesn't say that God did tell him, I rather speculate he did not tell him. That he said, Abraham, you do this by faith. You figure it out. The pieces of the puzzle are there if you think about it. By faith you can tell where to go. But how would you know where to go? You got the whole world in front of you. You can go really any one of four places. North, east, west, or south. Those are about your four choices, north, northeast, southwest. But we think that there was something that Abraham must have thought about that we think was the basis, the foundation for his faith. And this was something that is recorded in the Bible back in the, here's my notes here so I got it out, ninth chapter of Genesis. There was an experience in the ninth chapter of Genesis, you may recall, how after the flood, Noah goofed. He got drunk. He didn't realize what was happening, perhaps. He hadn't seen fermentation before. And you recall how one of his sons, Ham, uncovered his nakedness. And how when the whole episode came to light, there was a tremendous repercussion. And there was a curse that was put not upon Ham. Ham was the one who had uncovered his father's nakedness. But the curse didn't go upon Ham, but when one of his sons. Now, if God had cursed Ham, the curse would have gone to his sons as well, because these things went two and three generations. But he didn't. He selected one line of Ham, a line which we have no direct evidence was involved in the misdeed, may have been, but we have no evidence that he was involved. And he puts the curse upon this line. And this is recorded in Genesis 9, 25 to 27. And God said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. And God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant." Here was the curse. It was upon one of the sons of Ham, Canaan. Or is it a grandson? I don't recall. It was upon one of the descendants. I didn't check out which it was, son or grandson. But it's upon this descendant. And we think this was knowledge to Abraham that this curse was there. And he would have thought about this. Where does God want me to go? As he would have thought over all the input of knowledge he would have had, here was something that had a clue. He was the heir of the line of Shem. He was the patriarch, now that Terah had died, of the Shem line. And God had said once in the past, Canaan is going to be the servant of Shem. Maybe God is telling me that if I go down to where Canaan is, that is where the land that he's giving me is going to be. There we think there's a direct connection here between why this particular line was chosen and the promised land that went to the sons of Shem, eventually the Israelites. And that dwelling upon this, he said, that is something I will act on. And he moves southward to the land of Canaan, and then God gives him the confirmation, you've chosen right. Look about you, northwest, east, south. This is the land I'm going to give you, as far as your eye can see. And if that's correct, we think that he is interpreting one half of a long-range prophecy. We would suggest that verse 26 is a Jewish age prophecy, and verse 27 is a gospel age prophecy. And in 26, he is saying that Israel, the sons of Shem, would have a rulership over the land or the sons of Canaan in a very literal sense, in verse 26. But in verse 27, he goes into the gospel age when the sons of Japheth, the Gentile nations, would dwell in the tents or in the covenants of Shem, in the Semitic covenant and the Abrahamic covenant, and that which is symbolized by Canaan, the world of mankind, would become subservient to them. The meek shall inherit the earth. The church will have this larger promise that he goes on in a larger scope fulfilling, but that Abraham may have dwelt upon this first part and found there a foundation, a slight clue, very slight. But this is the point we want to make, is that faith is often based upon interpretation. We go back, we analyze, we think, what clue is the Lord giving me in his word or in providence as to what act I should make as my next step? The next act of faith is verse 11. Through faith also, Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. By faith, she received strength to conceive seed. When Sarah was promised in the final instance that she was going to have a son, remember her reaction? She laughed. Remember, she was there with Abraham when the three angels came, and Abram sent her in to prepare food, and she was eavesdropping. She was at the tent door when she overheard this angel tell Abraham, "The time has come, I'm going to fulfill my promise. Sarah is going to produce seed." And so she, at the tent door, laughed. And I think so often we do Sarah an injustice by saying that she laughed in scorn. She laughed in ridicule. We don't think that's the case at all. I think the evidence in the account back in Genesis 17 shows that she laughed in complete belief that God was able. And this is what's suggested. By faith, she received that strength. In the 21st chapter, I think it is. Yes, 21st chapter. When Isaac is born, verse 6, notice what she said. And Sarah said, "God hath made me to laugh, so that all that hear will laugh with me." God said, when you have this child, through the angel, you're going to name him Isaac. Laughter. Do these imply that she's ashamed of that laugh? It implies that she's thrilled with the fact that she laughed. She's happy with it. Would God give the child a name of ridicule, a laughter of scorn? He names her for that laugh. We think, again, it was instant acceptance. But she said, "Oh, it can't be," because the angel challenges her. "Why did Sarah laugh?" And she said, "Oh, no, I didn't laugh. No. You got it wrong. I wasn't laughing." But put yourself in Sarah's place. Be sympathetic. Here's a woman who wanted that seed desperately. She really wanted to have the child, and she couldn't. And finally, in desperation, when she knew it was impossible, she made an arrangement so that her handmaid would produce the child. That didn't work out well at all. Because after the child was born, every evidence is her handmaid just rubbed it in and said, "I had the seed, you didn't." And that was awfully grating to Sarah. This was hard to take. And resentment, anger was building. And all of a sudden, "I'm going to have it after all. Yahoo!" And she laughs in exaltation. She comes out with this burst of laughter. And now the angel says, "I heard her laugh." She did it in herself. She didn't do it out loud. "I heard her laugh." "Oh, no, I didn't laugh. Just let me have the seed." No, because she saw the jealousy that were there, that were coming forth in that laughter, too. It was belief, but at the same time, it showed her jealousy. She said, "Oh, yes, you laughed because you believed." And it was impossible, physically impossible, for her to have that child. Because she had passed the change of her life. And she no longer was producing these egg cells, they even produce a seed. But she believed it so much, it regenerated the whole process. And she again got the strength to conceive. And the fact that this is true, go back to the 17th chapter. And notice Abraham does the same thing in chapter 17, verse 17. Abraham fell on his face and laughed, and he said, "Shall a child be born unto him that is 100, and Sarah that is 90 laugh?" Where was he when he was laughing? Flat on his face. That's what it says. He fell on his face and laughed. If you're laughing in scorn, do you fall on your face? No, you lean back. That's the physical action you take. What do you do when you fall on your face? You praise the person who told you something. That's the act of worship. He's giving obeisance. In worship, he is laughing. Oh, he said, but his reaction shows that he didn't believe it. He said, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee." But notice what God said in verse 20. "And as for Ishmael, I have heard thee." God was saying, "What you requested for Ishmael, I'm doing." He wasn't saying, "Oh, that Ishmael might live instead of Isaac." He knew his wife. He knew the problems that were there. He knew these bitter jealousies. And he knew the laws of that day, the customs. And the customs of that day were cruel. Under these conditions, where the handmaid had produced a child only at the direction of the wife, if the wife had a child, she had the right to kill, literally kill, the son of the handmaid, so that her child would be the heir. And that's what Abraham was afraid of. And he had ample reason to be. You know what happened later? She said, get rid of him. You guys said, yeah, just go get rid of him. Then God said, I'll protect him. But she did demand that. She virtually demanded his death. She wasn't cruel enough to take a knife to him. But she put him out there where there was no food out in the desert and said, let him starve to death. And he almost did, if it hadn't been for the well of Beersheba. It was that close. And that's why God said, I've heard thee. He'll live. He'll live. It was, oh, that Ishmael might also live. So this, we think, was the act of faith that God had made a promise. And the promise may have seemed outdated because there had been such a long delay. But the merest reiteration that promise is still valid was ground for an instant quickening of the heart, an instant laugh, an instant rejoicing. And that's how that word laugh is translated in Isaiah, in the prophecy, rejoice, O barren that did not bear. Laugh. He's using that as part of the prophetic symbol of the rejoicing and the laughter of the acceptance. The promises once made, although time seems to indicate they have fallen dead, are never dead. Believe them. And as soon as there's an indication they're about to be fulfilled, laugh. Don't bother doing it in your heart, do it right out loud. Because it's a cause to rejoice. Going to skip on because of time to verse 20. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. Now this is a verse that you can interpret three different ways as to what the act is. You might say by faith, Isaac blessed Jacob. Or you might just say by faith, Isaac blessed concerning things to come. But the act of faith that is noted is by faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. And we think the important word in that verse is the three-letter word AND. By faith, he blessed Jacob and Esau. You remember the incident of that blessing in Genesis 27, how although Jacob had bought the birthright, he wasn't at all sure he was going to actually get the blessing. But when it came to the blessing, he knew that his father still wanted to give it to Esau. So you remember how he put on that coat of skin, he roughed it up, and he got himself smelling like an outdoorsman, and he came in, and poor old blind Isaac, so that must be Esau, and he blessed him. By deception, Isaac blessed Jacob. Then Esau came on the scene, and he said, that traitor, he's well named Jacob. Genesis 27:36. He supplanted me twice. He took away my birthright, and now he takes away my blessing. Haven't you got a blessing for me too? I'm sorry, but I've given it to him. Haven't you got another blessing? Well, yeah, I'll bless you too. And he gives him almost a duplicate blessing. In fact, in some ways, almost a superior blessing. To Jacob, he promises the dew of earth and the fatness of the heaven, and he says, your brother's going to be your servant. To Esau, he says, you can have the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth also, and you've got to serve your brother. But then he ends up, but when you shall have the dominion, you shall break his yoke from off your neck. It's going to be a temporary situation. So, really, if you and I were just looking at the account, I would be inclined to, if I were writing Hebrews, say, by deception, Isaac blessed Jacob, and by whining, he blessed Esau. Where is the act of faith that's involved, and what was the basis? We think the act of faith that is called here is the act of a dual blessing. That's what he said. By faith, he blessed both of them. The blessing is always connected with the concept of passing on of specific sets of promises to the firstborn son, or in this case, to the one who had the rights of the firstborn son. Now, it takes something to realize that maybe I can pass on more than this. Upon what did he base his decision to give a double blessing? We think upon the 17th chapter of Genesis. We've already talked about that prayer of Abraham, where Abraham prayed, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee." And by God's answer to that prayer, "As for Ishmael, I have heard thee." That here he was faced with a problem. I really want to bless Esau. That's what Isaac, he really wanted to. But can I? And as he thought back, my father had the same difficulty. He really wanted to have a blessing for Ishmael too. And God said, "Yes, you can have a blessing for him. It's subordinate. It's a secondary blessing, but there's a blessing for him too." And that by faith, he took that little hint and he applied it to his generation and he gave a dual blessing. And then you come down to Jacob and he applies the same act of faith and he blesses one of the sons predominantly. And then he gives subordinate blessings to all the others in the 49th chapter of Genesis. You know, God does the same thing. He's got a primary blessing for you if you're faithful. But he's got a great secondary blessing for the world of mankind. It's a fantastic blessing for all of them. That's what this preshadows. The last instance, I see your chairman is coming. Go to verse 21. By faith Jacob, when he was a dying, blessed both the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning upon the top of his staff. Jacob had to make a decision. In 1 Chronicles, the 5th chapter, first two verses, you'll find that Reuben, the firstborn, had lost the right of the firstborn because he defiled his father's bed. Now, Jacob had to make a decision, who should I bless? He said, well, it was natural for him to choose Joseph because Joseph was the firstborn son of his favored wife. But sometime read Deuteronomy 21, 15 to 18. That's prohibited. You can't take the firstborn of a favored wife and make him precedent over the firstborn of a less favored wife. So it's got to be based on something else than that. You can say, well, the secondborn, Simeon, the thirdborn, Levi, they forfeited also because they were involved in that nasty little incident up there with Shechem, where they had all the people of Shechem murdered. But then you come to the fourthborn son, Judah. And there is certainly a high blessing for Judah. Jesus comes from him. Abrahamic covenant goes through his line. And that's what 1 Chronicles said. The birthright and the genealogy are two separate things. Treat them differently. The genealogy goes through Judah. But he chooses Joseph to give the blessing to. Why? We think the key is right here in the verse. We think of a very bad translation in the last half of verse 21. There's a seeming bit of trivia thrown in. And worshipped, leaning upon the top of his staff. Well, who cares if he was leaning on his staff, or if he had a cane, or what he was leaning on? In fact, some translations said he leaning on his bedstead. What is the significance of that last phrase? Worship, leaning upon the top of his staff. I'd like to suggest, those of you who haven't got it here, when you go home, take out your emphatic diaglot. Look at this verse. Read the footnote. It's a fascinating footnote. And it suggests that there is virtually a paraphrase we can make. And I may not be paraphrasing it in the same words as the diaglot, but that paraphrase would read this way in that verse. By faith, Jacob, when he was a dying, blessed both the sons of Joseph, basing that decision upon the height of Joseph's staff. He's not talking about Jacob's staff, but he's talking about Joseph's staff. A staff carried the weight and the symbol of authority. And now he was looking over his sons. Who should I give the blessing? I can't give it to Reuben. He doesn't deserve it. Who does deserve it? And he looks down and he sees this one staff, head and shoulders above all the other staff, the staff of the grand vizier of Egypt. There. God has blessed Joseph. Where God has shown his blessing, I will give my blessing. And we think that he based that decision upon his observation of where God had shown his favor and his blessing. And that's a very adequate foundation for faith in our life. Looking for those evidences where God is blessed and saying, yes, I will cast my blessing along that same line where God has cast his blessing. And you can go on through Hebrews 11. You can notice in every incident how that there are little things upon which the ancients could have thought that may have been the foundation upon which they built great things, giant acts of faith. The old song we used to have is still very true. Little things mean a lot. To look back and to think upon those little clues in our life, those little clues in God's Word, and believing wholeheartedly, say, I not only believe it, I'm going to step forth on it and act upon it. And in doing that, we are acting upon faith and the principle of faith building.
Thank you, Brother Carl. That was a very insightful analysis of the details of the foundations of faith of God's ancient ones of old. May we be more aware of God's leadings in our lives so that signs of his dealings with us might strengthen our faith to likewise prove our fidelity to him. Before we...
Asking for strengthening of our faith, asking for perception of thy word and of thy providences so that we may act aright and